It is sort of a common idea that you are more content and happy if you realize that you have blessings and you count those blessings. A lot of people give that advice. But there's no better way to realize how we are blessed than to do what we've done today. To gather in the name of Christ and remember what God has done for us through the gift of His Son. And to realize in so many ways God has blessed us. It is the best way to start the week, and may all of us continue the week realizing how blessed we are and return that blessing with thanksgiving and even devotion to God. If you're visiting with us, that is what we would like for you to see today, that God has great blessings in store for you. We want to share those blessings with you. We want to enjoy those blessings with you, and so we're doing that today. And we would love for more opportunities to do that if that could be the case. So please come back and be with us. Have you ever been standing on the beach with the warm sun, the relaxing waves, and a gentle breeze just cascading across your skin? It's just like, it's just serenading you to peace. You also could be standing in the same spot, and that could be happening. Like was the case a few days ago in the southeastern United States with the hurricane. Horses are incredible animals. When I was young, we had horses, and oftentimes I rode horses and ponies. And they're great fun, and they're just wonderful creatures to be able to ride them and be around them. Of course, most of the horses you've probably been around and I've been around are tamed. An unbroken horse, a wild horse, is different. What a mighty creature and a dangerous creature they can be. Medicines are great. They can restore health. They can keep us healthy. They can completely revitalize our lifestyle. Properly prescribed, properly taken. But medicines that are taken that are not prescribed or not taken properly as they're prescribed and taken in an extensive and an overdose kind of way, be deadly. That which is beneficial, out of control, can be destructive. The Bible throughout talks about the opposite being true. The first shall be last, the last shall be first. The wise are foolish, and those thought to be foolish are really the wise. And today I want you to consider with me how that power is frail, and that meekness is actually power. We begin with the case of an Old Testament king by the name of Og. Og was one of the wicked and ferocious kings of the Canaanite area. The Israelites encountered Og when they made their way up to invade the Canaan land and made their way up on the east side of the Jordan River, and they encountered some of these big bad rulers. We read about this king, King Og of Bashan. In Deuteronomy 3, where it says, in retrospect, "And we took all his cities at that time. There was not a city that we did not take from them. 60 cities, the whole region of Argob, the kingdom of Og and Bashan, and all these cities were fortified with high walls, gates, and bars." It's like a formidable foe, doesn't it? Interesting enough, this Og was a man of renown even after his demise. Later in Deuteronomy, it says in chapter 3, verse 11, "For only Og, the king of Bashan, was left of the remnant of the Rephaim." Who are these people? Rephaim. These were the giants of the Old Testament. The men of overly normal stature. Just like Goliath later on. And look what it says about Og. "Behold, his bed was a bed of iron. Is it not in Reba of the Ammonites? 9 cubits was its length and 4 cubits its breadth, according to the common cubit. Now, this is an 18th century engraving that somebody made in their imagination. But even after Ogg's demise, they had his bed and they put it on display. It was like in a museum or something. The bed was approximately 13 feet in length and 6 feet wide, made of iron. Now, that's impressive. But look what Numbers says about him. Earlier in the Old Testament, when it describes the actual invasion and conquering of this Bashan area, it says, "Then they turned and went up by the way to Bashan, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against them, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. But the Lord said to Moses, 'Do not fear him.'" Now, I don't know about you, but he's a guy to be feared, isn't he? This Og. But God says, "Don't fear him, for I have given him into your hand and all his people and his land. And you shall do to him as you did to Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon." So they defeated him and his sons and all his people until he had no survivor left, and they possessed his land. Og's defeat is referenced 22 times in the Old Testament. 22 times in the Old Testament scriptures. This giant who got taken down. He was, by any human, earthly, worldly measurement, someone you didn't want to mess with. Someone who got what he wanted, who took what he wanted, who was perched on top with mighty strength, but who fell to God's people because God brought him down. Og, mighty man who lost his land. I want you to consider some statements found in the Psalms, Psalm 37. In Psalm 37, I want to read a series of statements here from this psalm, and I want you to think a little bit about Og, but I want you to think about, as the text is telling us, God's people. Psalm 37, verse 9. "For the evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait for the Lord shall inherit the land." Verse 11, "But the meek shall inherit the land and delight themselves in abundant peace." Verse 22, "For those blessed by the Lord shall inherit the land, but those cursed by him shall be cut off." And then down in verse 32, "The wicked watches for the righteous and seeks to put him to death. The Lord will not abandon him to his power or let him be condemned when he is brought to trial. Wait for the Lord and keep his way, and he will exalt you to inherit the land. You will look on when the wicked are cut off." Do you see Og in that? And then I want you to note that there are some inherent things in these statements. First of all, there are two sides being talked about, two groups being talked about. There are people who are characterized as righteous and meek, and those who are characterized as the wicked. You also see a progression of time and stages in what is said here. The wicked seem to flourish for a time. The idea that they're cut off meant that at one point they're not cut off. They're in power. But eventually, though they were at one time a threat to the righteous are delivered. In time, because they wait on the Lord, eventually they are delivered by the Lord. So the lesson from Psalm 37, from those statements that we read, is that God's people who are meek will be blessed, but they'll be blessed in the end. There are stages to this. And they will be blessed and delivered and saved and given great things, even over those who before had great power, but because of their wickedness are overthrown. And all of this, in a way, can be summed up by the words of Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount, in the Beatitudes, where he says, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." In the Sermon on the Mount, found in Matthew 5-7, Jesus is speaking of his kingdom. It's an otherworldly kingdom. It's a completely different kind of kingdom than humans experience. It's one ruled by heavenly values. It's people whose main citizenship trait is that of true righteousness, of the true variety of the heart. It's people whose hearts and values are very different than the world around them, whose allegiance lies with the will of God, and whose treasure is placed in heaven, the home of God. And Jesus says of those who are in his kingdom, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." The meek. This word, as used by the Greeks, basically means gentle. It means mild. And it usually is applied to relationships. How one treats others. How one responds and interacts with others. And the Greeks used it to describe things like gentle breezes, tamed horses, and medicines. What do all those three things have in common? When they are controlled, they are beneficial. When they're out of control, they're destructive. So at its root meaning, this expression that we have in our English Bibles, meek, at its root it means strength or power that's under control. Jesus is teaching us is that we're to be people under control. People who are subdued when others are attacking. People who are channeling the inner energy and strength and power that every human has. People who are channeling that to the will of God. Jesus is teaching us to refrain from exerting power in our relationships in such a way where we are acting for self and we're acting against others. We're controlled. And this is not something that the world values. Jesus' Sermon on the Mount was in such contrast to the values of the Roman Empire of his day. It is Julius Caesar who said, "I came, I saw, I conquered." Probably heard that. Though the Romans were really big on law, and even Julius Caesar himself, he did once say, "If you must break the law, do so to seize power." Now that is what it means to be Roman right there. That's what the Romans admired. That's what their empire was built upon. The whole Roman value system was about conquering and seizing power. And we're all understand, if you're a Bible student, you understand the vast influence of the Roman Empire and the might of the Roman Empire. And you also know that the Jews were bristling under Roman occupation, the taxes and the presence of the military and the things that were going on that just so offended them, the Jews that were religious as well as the Jews that wanted political independence. And that's why you see underlying Jesus' interaction with his Jewish brethren, you see even as late as after the resurrection that the apostles are asking, "Lord, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel?" Well, in a matter of days, with the preaching at Pentecost, Jesus is going to provide the greatest restoration of all. And that is the preaching of the gospel that offers man the remission of his sins so that he can be restored to God and a new kingdom be born. They're wanting him to restore Israel, which means back to the glory, the zenith days of Saul, David, and Solomon, where they could throw off the oppression of the Romans and be free. That is why sometimes the crowds were being whipped into a messianic frenzy when Jesus did miracles And it was, they were heading the wrong direction. We see that after the feeding of the 5,000 in John 6, the crowd was whipped up, and perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Didn't Jesus come to be a king? Oh, not like this kind of king. They were trying to start a revolution. This was going to be their leader who would help them declare their independence and crush the might of the Roman Empire. Meekness is not valued by the world, then and now. Our day is no different. People look for whatever leverage they can exercise against their neighbors, against their friends, their family members, especially their rivals at work, to try to elevate themselves and keep other people down. Live in the age of trash-talking your opponent and dancing in his face when you score and thumping your chest all the way back to the bench. That's what's glorified in our culture. The world says, promote yourself. The world says, look out for yourself. Nobody else is going to. The world says, fight back when someone offends you and mistreats you. The world says, chase, push, claw, elbow, scrape. That's how you win it all. Jesus says, blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Jesus calls his people to gentleness and tenderness in our dealings with other people, and not to roll over and crush them with a selfish agenda. And what of the outcome? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. We will inherit the earth? Well, this is right from the spirit of Psalm 37. Do you remember that? It's found in several places there. But understand two things. First of all, the messianic prophecies in the Psalms and in the writings of the prophets like Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel, they oftentimes spoke in very physical terms. However, when the Messiah came, we understand that that physical salvation, that physical kingdom, that physical deliverance, that physical glory was really not physical at all, but there was to be glory and freedom and might and prosperity in a spiritual way. Jesus speaks in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 and verse 3, when he begins it, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. The term poverty there, poor in spirit, it means one who is so impoverished that they're begging. It's somebody who's crouching down and begging for something. Blessed are the poor, but not the financial poor. You can be poor and be a wicked person. Blessed are the poor in spirit. The person who realizes their poverty before God. The person who realizes their low state before God. It's a statement of humility. It's not about earthly possessions, nor is this statement, inherit the earth. It's about spiritual possessions. It's about the spiritual land. You know, if you want earthly possessions, that is what you want, that is what you want most of all, you don't care about anything else, and you want as much as you can get, I would advise you not to be meek. I also would advise you that's not the path to go. But if that's the path, meekness is not your solution. Many, maybe even a majority of people who have acquired most of this world's goods and this world's power and this world's status have done so not by being meek. They've done so by being aggressive and selfishly destructive toward other people. Now, sometimes that does backfire. That someone is aggressive and destructive and selfishly rolling over everyone, and sometimes in this life it backfires. But there are a lot of people who have succeeded in this life, and meekness was not the secret of their success.